All right, welcome back to the Deep Dive. Today we're diving into the sometimes murky waters of corporate takeovers. We'll be taking a close look at a pretty landmark legal case, MAI Basic 4 versus Prime Computer. It's a case that really digs into how these tender offer rules actually work and gets to a crucial question, just who is considered a bidder when these high-stakes deals are going down.
Yeah, you hit the nail on the head there. This case, it goes all the way back to the late 1980s, but it grapples with this fundamental question that we still see today. You know, when one company is trying to buy another, who exactly needs to tell everyone what their involvement is? It's not always so clear-cut. You know, the Williams Act, which is what we're really looking at here, it's all about trying to make things transparent and protect shareholders during these kinds of takeover attempts.
Right, and this whole thing with MAI Basic 4, it really illustrates that perfectly. So let's set the stage here. Late 80s, big hair, shoulder pads, and MAI Basic 4, along with two other players, ChoiceCorp and Brooke Partners. They were all under this umbrella of Basic, right? And they were trying to buy up Prime Computer through a cash tender offer.
Yeah, 20 bucks a share was on the table.
20 bucks a share, not bad.
Seems like a decent deal at first glance, right? But it wasn't a simple take it or leave it kind of offer. Basic had this big hurdle they had to clear. They needed to get at least 67% of Prime's shares. And to do that, well, they needed a ton of cash, a massive financing package. We're talking bank loans and let's not forget those infamous junk bonds. Hundreds of millions of dollars all told.
Okay, now when we talk about the folks officially making the bid here, we've got MAI Basic 4, ChoiceCorp, and Brooke Partners. And I think Brooke Partners put in 20 million of their own cash, right?
Yeah, that's right. 20 million straight from their pockets.
But then to really get this deal moving, you've got $650 million in bank financing and another, what was it, $875 million in junk bonds. That's serious cash. And who is behind arranging and placing all that?
Well, that's where a company called Drexel Burnham Lambert enters the picture. And this is where things start to get interesting.
Drexel Burnham Lambert. Okay, so they're not just your average lender, are they? It sounds like they had their fingers in a lot of pies in this whole deal. So what were some of those other roles they were playing?
Yeah, they were wearing multiple hats, that's for sure. So on one hand, they were acting as Basic's investment advisor. That's pretty standard stuff when you have an investment bank involved in a takeover. But they also had a direct equity stake in Basic itself.
Interesting.
So they weren't just advising, they were actually putting their own money on the line as an investor. And then, of course, they were the underwriter for all those junk bonds the folks tasked with selling them to raise the rest of the cash.
Okay, so they really had a dog in this fight, huh? Not just from the fees they'd earn if the deal went through. I mean, those fees alone must have been pretty substantial if everything had worked out the way they planned.
Oh, absolutely. We're talking huge potential profits for Drexel if Basic successfully acquired Prime. And Prime Computer, well, they saw this whole picture, Drexel's deep involvement, their potential to profit, and, you know, maybe some whispers about Drexel's own financial stability at the time. And they basically said, hold on a second, this doesn't seem right.
Right.
They argued that Drexel was so deeply intertwined with this acquisition that Prime's shareholders had a right to know about Drexel's own financial situation.
Full transparency, right.
Transparency, exactly.
Yeah.
And that brings us to what became the central legal question in all this. Should Drexel Burnham Lambert, even though they weren't the ones officially trying to buy the shares, should they have been considered a bidder under the Williams Act?
Because if they were considered a bidder, that would have triggered a whole set of requirements for them to disclose information about the financial health, their involvement, the whole nine yards.
Exactly. And this is what the courts had to grapple with. Now, the district court, they sided with Prime initially. They look at just how much Drexel was involved, how active they were, and they decided, yeah, this level of participation, it means they need to be treated as a bidder when it comes to disclosure. So they hit the pause button, issued a preliminary injunction to stop Basic's tender offer until more information about Drexel was out in the open.
Makes sense. But of course, Basic wasn't just going to roll over, right? They appealed that decision all the way to the First Circuit Court of Appeals. So then the appellate court had to weigh in, was the lower court right to stop the offer in its tracks because of this lack of information about Drexel?
And in the end, the First Circuit, they backed up the district court. They agreed that the scope of Drexel's involvement, it meant that disclosure was absolutely necessary.
Right.
And their reasoning here, it's crucial for understanding how the definition of bidder can be a lot broader than just the company with their name on the offer.
Okay, let's get into that reasoning then. What were the things about Drexel's involvement that really stood out to the First Circuit? What convinced them that, yeah, this needs to be disclosed?
Well, the court really zeroed in on Drexel's active participation. I mean, they weren't just passively writing checks. They were in the thick of it, helping to plan and execute this entire tender offer right from the start.
Right. And like we said earlier, they weren't just consultants, right? They had skin in the game with that equity stake in BASIC. How did the court factor that into their decision?
Oh, that equity stake was a big deal. It meant Drexel's financial success was directly tied to the success of the takeover. So their motives were potentially a bit more complicated than just an advisor getting paid a fee. And it wasn't just that. Drexel also had the potential to wield some serious influence over BASIC. They were planning to get a seat on the board, and not just any seat. It came with veto power within another company that actually controlled Brook Partners, one of the official bidders. The court definitely picked up on that level of influence, especially at such a high level.
Now let's talk about the elephant in the room here, the financing. I mean, this whole offer hinged on securing an insane amount of funding, hundreds of millions. What happened if those junk bonds Drexel was in charge of selling? What if they couldn't find enough buyers?
That was a major sticking point, and it was a key part of why the First Circuit ruled the way they did. See, there wasn't a legally binding contract that said Drexel had to step in and cover the difference if they couldn't sell all the junk bonds. But the court, they saw right through that. They found that there's a very clear expectation that Drexel would likely do just that, you know, throw in more of their own money to make sure the deal closed. And that expectation, even without a formal contract, well, it showed a much deeper commitment and influence than your average arm's-length lender, right?
Right. So the court wasn't just looking at the black and white of the contracts. They were trying to understand the reality of the situation, the intent, the anticipated course of events. It sounds like they were really trying to get to the bottom of who was truly calling the shots in this deal.
That's exactly it. They were trying to figure out who had the real power, who was making things happen behind the scenes. And this leads into the whole concept of a group under the Williams Act.
Okay, tell me more about that.
Well, you see, Sections 13D and 14D, along with this Rule 14D1B1, they all recognize that these takeover attempts, they often involve a whole team of players, not just a lone wolf company going after another. So these rules, they say that if a group of individuals or entities are all working together, you know, with a shared goal of acquiring another company's securities, then they've got to disclose what they're up to. The First Circuit, they looked at Drexel and they saw a key player in this whole coordinated effort, like they were part of a team with BASIC in their bid to take over Prime. This whole group concept, it's there to prevent these sneaky tactics, where bidders try to skirt the rules by dividing up the work and pretending they're all acting independently.
Right. It's about seeing through the smoke and mirrors and understanding the substance of the relationships, the overall strategy, not just who happens to have their name on the official paperwork. And I'm guessing Drexel's own financial situation at the time, you know, with those SEC violations that they had and that plea bargain, I bet that factored into the court's thinking too.
You bet it did. The court basically said, look, information about Drexel's financial health and the fact that they had these recent run-ins with the SEC, this is all super important for Prime shareholders to know. In the world of securities law, we call this kind of information material. It means a reasonable investor would probably want to know about it before making a decision, like whether to sell their Prime shares in this tender offer. How could shareholders really weigh the risks and benefits of the offer if they didn't know about the potential instability of the folks bankrolling the whole thing?
Right. It's all about having all the cards on the table. And I think you mentioned earlier that the court actually referred back to another case, Interco, in their analysis. How did that precedent come into play here?
Oh, yeah. Interco. That was another case that dealt with this whole question of disclosure and tender offers. But what the First Circuit did in EMEA Basic 4, it really built on that earlier decision. It put even more emphasis on looking at what everyone involved in the acquisition was actually doing, you know, what their function was. It wasn't just about who was legally bound to buy shares. It was about who was making the acquisition happen, who had the power to make it succeed or fail.
I see. So it shifted the focus from just a formalistic view of, okay, who's the named bidder, to a more functional analysis of who's really pulling the strings here. And that's a really important distinction.
Really important, because it recognizes that you can have control and influence without actually owning the offer outright. This case helped to close a loophole that these groups were using to get around the disclosure requirements by working through these seemingly separate entities.
Right. They couldn't hide behind a bunch of shell companies or complicated arrangements anymore. And if I remember correctly, the solution the court came up with wasn't to force BASIC to start from scratch with a whole new tender offer filing. They talked about something called curative disclosures, right? What did that look like in practice?
Yeah, that's a really good point. It shows how practical the court was trying to be. They didn't say, okay, scrap everything and file a brand new Schedule 14D1. That's that big formal document with all the details of a tender offer. Instead, they said, look, just add in the missing information about Drexel, their role, their finances, their legal issues, supplement what you've already filed. It was all about making sure shareholders had the information they needed to make an informed decision. The substance of the disclosure was what mattered most, not just checking off all the boxes on some procedural checklist.
Okay, so as we wrap things up here, what's the big takeaway for understanding who qualifies as a bidder under the Williams Act after all this? What kind of tests do we get from MAI Basic 4?
Well, it's not a simple test, that's for sure. MAI Basic 4 gives us this very fact-specific, functional test. There's no easy checklist to follow, but there are certain things the courts look at very closely. They'll consider how involved an entity is in planning and financing the tender offer, what kind of relationships they have with the official acquirer, and whether, in practice, they're acting as part of a group that's trying to buy up the target company.
So the message is clear. Even if you're not the one with your name on the offer, if you're playing a big role behind the scenes, you might still have to follow the disclosure rules.
100%. You can't just say, oh, I'm just an advisor, or I'm just providing financing, and think that lets you off the hook. If you're deeply involved and your own financial situation could affect the deal, you've got to be transparent.
Transparency is key. And for all of the law students out there listening, what's the big legal lesson they should walk away with from MAI Basic 4 versus Prime Computer? What's the principle that really stands out here?
The biggest thing to remember is that the Williams Act is all about protecting shareholders. It's about making sure everything is out in the open when these corporate takeovers happen. Courts aren't going to get hung up on technicalities or just look at who's officially the bidder on paper. They're going to dig deeper, figure out who's really in control, who's providing the essential support, and whether shareholders need to know about what those folks are up to. It's all about substance over form, understanding the reality of the situation.
So MAI Basic 4, it's not just some dusty old case. It's a real reminder that the definition of a bidder can be much broader than you might think. It includes anyone who's actively involved in trying to take over another company.
Exactly. And it forces us to look at the bigger picture. Consider the whole network of people and companies involved in these tender offers and figure out what kind of influence they have on the whole thing. That way, shareholders can make informed decisions, even when these deals get really complicated.
It really is a fascinating case, and it highlights all the complexities of these corporate maneuvers. Really appreciate you breaking it all down for us.
Happy to do it.
And for our listeners, next time you hear about a tender offer, think back to what we've discussed today. Remember MAI Basic 4. Always look beyond the obvious players, because the legal obligations can go much deeper, and it's all about making sure shareholders have the information they need to protect themselves. In today's financial world, these deals are getting more and more complex, so understanding these principles of disclosure is absolutely essential. It's something to keep in mind as you navigate your way through the world of law and finance.